Welcome to another episode of One on One with Joe O'Donnell, presented by SodaStick. Check them out at sodastick.com. More on them in a moment. Hope you're doing well. The regular season of the National Hockey League winding on down, my friends. The Minnesota Wild are in one uphill battle, but they continue to play great hockey. 7-2-1 in their last 10 games at the time of this recording. Tough loss to the Carolina Hurricanes the other night, but some big ones coming up. Nashville, St. Louis. In fact, St. Louis three times in the month of March alone. A lot of divisional games for the Wild as they look to continue to climb up and make what, you know, even a few weeks or months ago seemed like an improbable run to the Stanley Cup playoffs, but they put themselves in a spot with 20-plus games to go to make them all meaningful. We'll see how they handle the trade deadline and a whole lot more, but it has been fun watching the Wild play great hockey under John Hines and climb back into the playoff picture. Again, one-on-one with Joe O'Donnell, presented by SodaStick. That is sodastick.com, designed by Minnesotans for Minnesotans. Use code one-on-one for 15% off your next order. That's code one-on-one for 15% off your next order. I really love SodaStick because they do stuff like right up to the second. Right? So the locker room collection for the Wild or spring training for the Minnesota Twins, they put out new products all the time. So if it's something that's happening, a milestone within the Wild or the Dewar, Duhame, Dewey 1, Dewey 2, you know, they make shirts about all that stuff. So really cool. It's kind of like up to the second, whatever the latest trend or the latest thing is going on around the Wild locker room, SodaStick's usually making a shirt for it. All their apparel is designed and screen printed here in Minnesota on super soft, super comfy shirts and hoodies. Again, code one-on-one at sodastick.com for 15% off your next order. We appreciate their support. Thanks for listening. As always, don't forget to subscribe and like and share these podcasts with the other hockey fans in your life. Great guest today. Really thrilled to be joined by Ray Shiro, senior advisor to Wild GM Bill Guerin. But he's got a heck of a resume well before joining the Minnesota Wild organization a couple years back. Ray was the New Jersey Devils GM prior to joining the Minnesota Wild. He spent 8 years as the Pittsburgh Penguins GM, including helping them win the 2009 Stanley Cup. He also was an assistant GM for Ottawa and Nashville previous to all of that. And his father, Fred Shiro, is still in Philadelphia sports lore history. I mean, he's the only man to ever coach the Philadelphia Flyers to Stanley Cup championships. So we'll talk a little bit with Ray about a number of topics, including this time of year for a GM. He's got a ton of experience working in the National Hockey League for so many years, so many different capacities, several organizations. Unbelievable person, unbelievable personality. Really thrilled to have Ray Shiro join me here today on One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell. Again, presented by SodaStick. Hope you're enjoying this Minnesota Wild season as it continues to wind down. Hopefully they get into the Stanley Cup playoffs and make a run. They've been dealing with a ton of injuries, ton of adversity, but they are playing great hockey down the stretch. As always, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy this conversation with Ray Shiro. Ray, thanks for joining me. First off, how have you been? Where are you located these days?
I'm actually living in Boston, but be joining up with the Wild here in about a few days, obviously, for the trade deadline coming up. And we got, I think, 4 games left, so everything's going well besides that. And obviously, the big games coming up, the next couple against Nashville and St. Louis, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Didn't realize you were a St. Paul, Minnesota native. How long did you live in Minnesota?
Actually, my dad was coaching the Minnesota St. Paul Fighting Saints at the town time, so I only lived in St. Paul, actually White Bear Lake. I was born in St. Paul, but until I was 4 years old. So, but I still have nice memories and recollections of falling down on the ice, and we lived in White Bear Lake, so, and getting stitches. So, some good memories of St. Paul skating down at the rink when my dad was coaching the Fighting Saints. And even though it's funny, I can remember that stuff, let alone not much from last week, but it was incredible. It's really great. It was a big impact. And my dad was there for 6 years, my mom and dad, and both my brother and myself were born in St. Paul. So, very fortunate, and we still have friends back there. And, you know, it's been great to be able to come back to the Wild. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Did you feel like it was sort of, you came full circle? I mean, your career has spanned so many decades in the NHL. You've worked in a number of different capacities, and now you circle back to where it all kind of started for you. Maybe your love of the game, even going back to your Minnesota roots. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. I think just, great memories, even going to the games back then. You know, it was probably my mom's lap, but you know, public skating when I was 3 or 4 years old, trying to shuffle around the ice. And but I really think so. And it's funny, just even coming back to Minnesota, just obviously with the ownership of Craig Leopold. And I was in Nashville as the assistant GM for 8 years, and Craig was the owner there. And then certainly, obviously, with Billy Guerin, that my familiar with him. Obviously, he's helped me, and maybe a little vice versa, but more him helping me when I traded for him in 09 in Pittsburgh, helped us win the cup and had two great seasons for us, and then came back a couple years later in player development. And that's his path has led him to the GM seat in Minnesota.
As an advisor, how do you try to help Billy Guerin? I mean, you just said he's taught you a bunch as well throughout your career, but for fans that aren't really sure exactly what role an advisor takes on within an organization, how do you try to support him?
I think when I was, I think the senior advisor role, or it could be any sort of title, I think more it's the experience that, and really information gathering, I think is important. And, you know, I was 8 years assistant GM for David Poyle. And I remember him telling myself that, you know, as assistant GM, the GM, I need information. And so realistically, ideas, information. And I think a lot of that through collaboration and so forth. And it's beneficial for everybody in the organization. It certainly helps people grow. And I was very fortunate with that with David. And what I think with Billy, I think those things run things by me. And, you know, we kick around the group and so forth. And again, my opinion is just based on my experiences, but really at the end of the day, that's what the GM job is, to take all the opinions and have to make that final decision, which is the biggest change from being an assistant GM to a GM, is that's the big difference. And but anyway, he's got good people around him and they've been there a number of years. And but anyway, that was one of the things. And I think hopefully I'm helpful in that role. But I love being around the game and love exchanging ideas with the guys and meeting and working with new people. So that's been fun.
What's impressed you the most about the Wild's recent play?
Very resilient. You know, coming back, I think from the All-Star break, I think it's been about 10 games or so, and we're really getting carried by certainly our top players have been fantastic. And but still, you know, we've got some identity in that line that Heinze put together with Lettieri and Dewar, and I think Duhaime, or maybe even with Hartman down to a certain extent. And I think to be a successful team, it's not really a one through four lines. It's a, you know, it's everybody. It's a, you know, it's the depth of your roster and how you play. But I think it's been a real resilient team. And you know, it's, and again, it's, you know, two big games coming up here, especially with the way Nashville's playing, and certainly it's put the pressure on us. But it's been a resilient group, and going to Nashville, it's going to be the biggest game of the year for us, I would think. And there's been a many of them. But you know, through that, I think, you know, you see growth in your team, you see growth in your players, and it's been a hard year. And you know, especially, you know, it's hard. It didn't go off to a good start, and a real good coach and a real good man lost his job in Dean Evason, and certainly Bobby Woods. And it's just, you know, and the team responded when Heinze came in, and then obviously didn't play as well. And certainly since the break, you know, I played good hockey. And but again, it's you know, it's crunch time, but it's a fun time. You're in it, and these games are important. And it's good to see the growth of the players playing under that sort of pressure. And again, you know, the games come up this weekend or tomorrow and Saturday are going to be incredibly, 3 games in 4 days. It's incredibly important. But that's the excitement of playing in the NHL and being in a playoff race.
I know you know Chuck Fletcher very well, and I'm pretty sure he was the man that told me many years ago, or said it in passing, that, you know, especially at the AHL level, that a playoff game is like two regular season games, right? From an experience and development standpoint. And you just talked about some of these younger players from Minnesota getting this experience now, these crunch time games, got to win to get in sort of approach. How much do games like this benefit players old and younger, I guess, you know, rookies, second year guys, or the veterans, as far as their careers go and ultimately getting them to that winning pedigree that you want to have?
Yeah, and then some of these guys have won in the past, obviously, but you know, as a group with the Minnesota Wild or slash Iowa Wild, I think it's important to be in those meaningful games. And again, it's, you know, it's when I was in Pittsburgh for 8 years and basically win 50 games a year for a joke. And you know, there's not a lot of adversity, or there was 1 or 2 years, but you know, this is what you're going through now. And even in Iowa, obviously with Brett McClain, first year head coach, and you know, through the injuries he had, it's hard to restock that roster. You know, once the season started, all those call-ups and so forth. But it's, you know, important for this, the team and this group. And I think even from, you know, the growth from management, the general manager standpoint, coach everybody grows through this type of thing. And, you know, the best part of a couple is coming up for every NHL general manager and front office is the trade deadline, obviously. And then, you know, the other ones are the draft and certainly free agency. But it's an exciting time. It's a nerve-wracking time for people. And but I think you find a lot about your team in discussions with other teams. You find out who likes your players and vice versa. And while things may or may not happen at the deadline for teams, these are where things, you know, I might not want to do it now, but you know what? Maybe after the season, let's talk after the season and these things. So I think everybody grows through situations like this and you find out about your team and growing as a group.
It's certainly an uphill battle for the Wild to get in the Stanley Cup playoffs because you're not just trying to jump one team. There's, you know, five teams, maybe for one spot, six teams for two spots if you factor in the Kings. What does your experience tell you, Ray, about these types of situations where, like John Hines said it after the loss to Carolina, like, yes, the Nashville game is big, but I can't say it's the biggest game of the year because we've got 23 left after that. So what are these times of year like for management, coaches, and players?
I think it's the signs he said. I've been through this before with him in New Jersey. And we had, you know, the year we made the playoffs, we had 97 or 98 points. And we made, I think, the second to last day of the year. But I still remember our biggest game of the year was right around here. Is we had lost to Winnipeg and we're going on a 5-game road trip starting in Nashville. And I think they had just gone to the finals the year before. And we went on a shootout, but we talked about that game and it was the biggest game of the year that day. And then the biggest challenge for anything is because there's the emotional factor that comes into play on a win, trying to regroup, you know, or after a loss, like even last night. Oh God, you know, and that, okay, well, you know what? That's the excitement of it. And I think the coaching staff, no matter what, whether it's a win or a loss, the next morning is, you know, the emotional part of it. You've got to get ready. And what's the challenge for the group, the next game, or what's going to, you know, get them. And, you know, certainly, you know, and I think Kanzi's right, you know, there's 23 games left and I think there's four until the trade deadline. But again, the trade deadline, you know, that's not in the coach's mind, that's for sure. The coaching staff is, you know, worried about the Nashville game and that's where they're going to go. And, but again, it's an exciting part of the time for the group and a little nerve wracking, but you know, it's a great place to be. And it'd be better to be, you know, securely in a playoff spot, but that's just not the way it is. And that's not really the league and that's not where we are this year, but this group, I believe, is going to keep fighting. And as I said, what I'm impressed about is the resiliency of the group and the staff. And hopefully that's going to carry over.
Tell me about John Hines, how well you know him, what separates him as a coach and a person.
I've known John a long time. And when I was in Pittsburgh, I actually hired him. I think it was back in 2009 as assistant coach to Todd Reardon in Wilkes-Barre, our farm team. And after 1 year, Todd Reardon was promoted to assistant coach in Pittsburgh. And we promoted John Hines as head coach and assistant coach of Lane Nazarbine. And so I've known him a long time. And obviously, I was in Jersey. I hired him as his first time as a head coach in 2015. He's prepared. He's passionate. And I think with John is really great. He's a great communicator. And I think there's three things in coaching that you really need: teach, inspire, and discipline. I think Heinze's got those. And I really like the fact that, you know, he's grown at every stop. And, you know, and I know Billy has seen that, I think. And, you know, he's always wanting to learn. And, you know, he's done this in the offseason or even he used his time when between jobs in Nashville and to really learn from other sports and other coaches. And I think that's great. And I think it's a good thing for the group. And the same thing to pass on to players. You're always looking to prove yourself. And I think that's what Heinze does. And it's there's no gray areas. And, you know, just he's a good communicator with his players and his staff. And I think that's been beneficial for him. And again, I love the growth that I've seen in as a coach and the confidence. And I think it's been a real good thing for our group.
I understand if you can't share too much into this, but when the organization decides to move on from Dean Evason and Bob Woods, was there any doubt that John Hines would be the guy, given the fact that you and Bill Guerin knew him so well? He was obviously out of work at the time. Anything you could share on that process from an organizational standpoint would be awesome.
Yeah, that'll be easy because I think this was someone that Billy had in his mind if he had to make a move. And, you know, that was as painful as that was for Billy because of the respect he has for Dean and Bob Woods. And again, when Billy called me, it was more of a affirmation of John Hines and, you know, and okay, here's what I know. And I don't believe I swayed him one bit either way. And it wasn't when we talked about any other names or like that. I think Billy did the due diligence in his mind and but knew the type of coach he wanted for this team. And again, it's a difficult decision to make. And as a manager, and it's never easy. And, but again, I think, you know, with Heinze in this group, I think, you know, especially because we didn't get that start playing well right away. I mean, we would have been so far out of it at this point. And that was, you know, so I think the ebbs and flows have been, you know, high, kind of lower, high, and then, you know, but that's the way the game is, an 82-game season. And we're fortunate to be in this position because if we didn't get off to that great start when Heinze came in, and maybe it would have happened with Dean, who knows? It certainly happened in the past, but that's the situation the team was dealing with. And, you know, I think with John Heinze, it's more Billy Guerin's, knowing him from his Pittsburgh days, but seeing his growth as a coach. And I think that's the thing that with Billy and John, I think that was what kicked it off, because that's my recollection, because I think that's really when Billy called. And, you know, it was disappointing, but here's what I know, thing with John Heinze, whatever, you know, it's his team and whatever, you know, Billy wanted to do. So I'm glad it went so far so good, and hopefully best days are ahead too.
One more very specific Minnesota Wild question before I want to jump on to some other parts of your career and talk about, of course, winning the Stanley Cup. But Joel Eriksson Ek, I mean, this guy is he's an absolute machine. He plays in every situation. He's got a career high in goals again. Should be getting lots of attention for the Selke Trophy. If he's not, it's a travesty, in my opinion. But I just want to ask you if Joel Eriksson Ek reminds you of anyone you've had in the past. I mean, I know you drafted Jordan Staal, great two-way center. Saw that firsthand the other night with Carolina. Mm-hmm. Who does Joel Eriksson Ek remind you of? What do you think of him as a player?
That was an incredible draft pick by Chuck and Brett Flair. And it took a little bit of time, obviously, but having been here 3 years and watching this guy play, I mean, Jordan Staal is that's a good comparison, I think. And comparing guys is difficult, but I had a guy in New Jersey who was there before me, a first round pick by the Devils, and was Travis Ajak. And those two guys are, in my opinion, I would, you know, I think Eric connects the same way. You know, look back to 1980, the trade that Bill Torrey made for the Islanders with LA Kings to pick up Butch Goring as a number two guy behind Brian Trotcher. They go on and win four cups in a row. I believe you win the cups with guys like Eriksson Ek and Staal. And, you know, I would say the same thing about Travis Ajak. He got to the finals, but like even when, you know, we were selling 1 year, I wasn't ever looking to trade Travis anyway. But when I realized how good this guy was, I would just out of the blue in conversation with GMs. Hey, by the way, there's Ajak. Yeah. You guys might not know how good this is. I'm telling you, if he'd be the best guy to get as the number two to help you win a cup. And I wasn't trading him, but I look at that same thing with Joel Eriksson Ek. I mean, he is 200-foot player. Man, I mean, he should lead the league in penalties drawn, but you know, if he does, but his will, his compete, and you know, to see those top guys come back after the All-Star break and have really played great hockey for us. And but I'm really, really impressed by him. And it's having seen it every day too, growing out of it, you know, he's a very difficult guy to play against, kind of like obviously with Mikko Koivu. I mean, they're tough, and the same thing with Zajac and Staal, and they help you win. And it's a great thing that Billy's got under a great contract, and he'll be here for a long time. And you know, it's really a pleasure to watch him play and compete.
How did the job with the Ottawa Senators come about in 1993?
I was in the ages when I got out of St. Lawrence University. I was drafted by LA and went to camp, but I didn't get signed or anything like that. So I was actually considering, but like my buddies were down on Wall Street. Thank God I didn't do that. But I ended up moving to Boston and got in the agent business for 6 years. And I think when Ottawa got the team in 92, it was after their first season, and Randy Sexton was the president. And Randy and I, you know, Randy obviously with the Wild and longtime NHL executive, Randy and I played hockey together at St. Lawrence University. He was a couple years ahead of me, but we always kept a really great relationship. And when he became GM there, he asked me if I wanted to be his assistant GM. And that was back in 1993. And, you know, I was 30 years old, and, you know, I jumped at the opportunity, and, you know, I was very fortunate for that to come about. And I was there for 5 years and with the Senators, and we ended up, you know, from two or a couple bad, real tough years, as we know. And, but then, you know, to be part of that team that you first make the playoffs, and then you, you know, win a round, and Then you've, you know, then I went to, after 5 years, I went to Nashville for 8 years as assistant GM, but the Ottawa days were great and some great memories, like Jim Nill from Jim, the Dallas Stars was there, and John Ferguson Sr., Trevor Timmons. I had some really, Rick Bonus was our head coach, and Elaine Vino was our assistant coach. We had some really good guys, and we all laugh when we see each other, like, yeah, we were about 5 years too early in our careers, basically, except for John Ferguson Sr., but it was a great learning experience, a passionate fan base, and I really had a great time in Ottawa.
What's the most stressful part about being a general manager?
Did you say parts? well, I think with anything, it's the pressure, it's not so much from the outside, but, you know, the game has really, really changed, and so has life, certainly with social media. And I think with anything, it's around the trade deadline, you know, it's the trade deadline, the draft, free agency, certainly. Those are probably the three most critical times for an NHL general manager. And because, you know, you're making decisions to your staff and that are, you know, either going to, you know, really hopefully help your team and certainly could hurt your team and in the short or long term. So I think those are the pressure points. And now, of course, you know, you're always managing up for a general manager. And so you're, you know, obviously you're in contact with your ownership all the time in terms of what's going on and to collaborate with your staff and so forth. There's lots going on, and but it's a great time. And but it is nerve wracking. And, you know, it's I remember about the first big deal I ever did was in Pittsburgh. And I think it was my third year. And it was right at like a minute to go to the deadline trading for Marian Hossa. And I was in Ottawa with Marian when we drafted him. And but it was one of those things that, you know, I was shaking basically. And the deadline passed, like Chuck Fletcher was my assistant GM. And as soon as he got the facts into the league that the deal was done and Don Waddell from Atlanta signed off on it, I walked into Chuck's office. I'm like, he's like, all right. I'm like, I don't want to do it anymore. He's like, what? I already said it. I'm like, oh, what did I do? But it ended up being really good for the Penguins and stuff. But, you know, those are decisions that you have to make. And, you know, as you get more experience, I think that is somewhat helpful. But it's really, you know, those are the best times too with your staff and, you know, a lot of ideas and things like that. And that's really a fun time and a stressful time, but, you know, it's a good time. And but you find a lot, as I mentioned earlier, Jill, a lot about your team from talking to different, you know, it doesn't, you know, for the Minnesota Wild, it really doesn't care what Billy Guerin thinks about the players and their value. It's the other 31 GMs that, what do you mean you don't like this guy or that guy? We like him. Well, you know, who cares? Like, you know, we like our house, but no one else wants to buy it. So you find out the value of your players and still need players around the league that might be available. And, you know, so it's kind of, it's never ending, which is nice that it's year round, and what might not happen today might happen down the road. And I've been part of that before too. And some deals that you think are there just fall apart. And like, how the heck did that happen? But, you know, it's a competitive business, and but it's a great time, and for the fans as well. And certainly reporters like to report on this stuff and the what ifs. So.
Ray, how about the fact that you need to manage your emotions, right? A tough loss, not overreacting to it. Something happens to a player off the ice, whatever the situation is. And how much did you kind of grow into that, learning that, you know, a 5-game losing streak might not be the end of it all. And maybe on the flip side, a great winning streak, but we're not that good. Did you learn over time to sort of manage the emotions and the highs and lows throughout a season?
Yeah, I think so. But I think they're still there. And I think that's with anything, that's because, you know, you're competitive and there has to be emotion. There's emotion in anything in life. And that's the best part of being in the game, the highs and lows. And, but it's, you know, you kind of, I think managing that is part of, you know, your staff as well. And you talk to each other, and whether it's your head coach or your front office staff or whoever it is. And, you know, and I always found that beneficial in terms of, you know, One of my assistants might the next day or whatever, might, if something is off with me, yeah, I'm like, yeah, you know, but we just talk about it in terms of, you know, here's what we're thinking, or what do you think? And I don't know, it's, you know, I think that's part of the process, and I find that beneficial, and you know, engaging with your staff that way. So but those, you know, the gym jobs are 32 teams now, and they're exciting, they're difficult, and but at the same time, everybody wants one. And but it's nice to be part of a nice staff that we have in Minnesota.
When you're putting together a roster, how much would you consider the coach's philosophy, the type of player they like? Is that important from a GM perspective to keep that stuff in mind?
I think a lot of GMs are different in terms of how they communicate with their coaches. And, you know, I was a certain way, and maybe that was maybe my years with David Poile and Barry Trotz and so forth in Nashville. I like getting the background of the head coach, would say, if he knew a player or might didn't know a player. But again, the GM is, you know, making decisions on acquiring players or retaining players, and the player that the coach is going to coach him. But I think it's one of those things, you know, if your head coach says, you know, we really could use an upgrade in our fourth line or a penalty kill, or, you know, a little more speed on that third line or something. Okay. You have that, you know, the player, the replacement list, whatever that you're targeting. At the same time, you're looking at that, and, you know, that's the type of player you may need. But I think the communication is good, and to involve the coach. And but again, not every GM's like that. And that was just me. And maybe I just like the conversation, I guess. I don't know. But I would do that with my front office staff as well, and our pro scouts or amateur scouts, whatever. And, you know, talking hockey is one of the best parts of being in the game, and which is fun. And but again, it engages everybody. And at the end of the day, whenever a decision is made by the manager, whether the coach or anybody, if they don't agree with it, well, once it's made, you get behind it, that's for sure. And I always had coaches and people that worked with me that were very good like that. But that was the way I was. It was an assistant GM, like, okay, that's what David, okay, that's what we're going to do. And that's great. It's going to work. We're going to get behind it. And because that's why, you know, you're in that together and you're part of that team. And but again, it's the opinions are important and information is important. At the end, that general manager's got to make that final decision. And then whatever it's going to be, you're behind it. And it's hopefully going to work out for the best.
How much of analytics now impacted a front office's decision-making?
I think it's part of the process for sure. There's certain areas, like when I was in Pittsburgh, we had started with it. Like this was back in 2010, 11, maybe. But, you know, when I got to in New Jersey, probably my second year, was when I, you know, we really went kind of in. And I think it was Lou Lamoriello before me. And I worked with Lou for 2.5 months in Jersey. Lou, I think Sonny Mehta might have been the first analytics person, true analytics person hired by Jersey in 2014 before I got there. And I really enjoyed working with Sonny. And now he's the assistant GM in Florida. And the information, I think even, especially even with a coach, it's great the coach is open to this, especially when it comes to player usage. And, but you know, it's they can only look at so much, especially, you know, pre-game stuff or post-game stuff. Well, then it's a back-to-back sometime, you know, so it might be two or three sheets for the coach, but in terms of, you know, it's come player acquisitions and so forth, you know, it's really, we always like looking at it and, you know, keeping, you know, what about this? What about this? Or, you know, his metrics are this, you know, his player usage, and there's always something. And it's, you know, especially when it comes to defense, and I think analytics has been very difficult to actually assess some defensemen, unless, you know, they're, if you drive plays, that's great. Like, okay, Eric Carlson last year in San Jose, but there's certain, I'm not analytically like, oh, Jake Middleton's going to be what, but you know, everybody could use a guy like Jake Middleton, that's for sure. But I think, you know, it's a big part of the game now. It's a big part of business. It's a big part of sports. And, you know, you don't want to fall behind. You want to, you know, you want to try to find new things and to try to get that edge. And maybe you do, but if you don't even try, then you've really fallen behind. So, but it's been a process probably over 10 years or 12 years. It's really taken off. And, but again, it's good. And when coaches understand it, like we would spend time on it, almost have like a seminar with our assistant coaches as well. Even our pro scouts, they read about it in the paper, what these are, the numbers. Okay. What does it mean? So it's always good because they want to know. And I think, you know, it benefits everybody in the organization when you're up to speed on it in terms of what we're trying to do.
You mentioned the Marian Hossa deal that went through, even though maybe at the last minute you were thinking otherwise. Can you share a trade that was close to happening, close to being a done deal, but never came to fruition?
Not off the top of my head, but I, you know, it's funny. There's deals that you do make it right at the end and be like, oh, well, actually one of them was Bill Guerin when I traded for him in Pittsburgh in 2009 at the deadline, and he had a no trade, and the Islanders had, he was the captain of them, and the Islanders had sat him out for two or three games, and because they were going to trade him, and they were up, the guards know they were up front with him, and they came to my think and said, hey, we have a deal with Philly and the Rangers, will you waive? Yeah, okay, I'll go there. I just want to be in the playoffs. Well, sure enough, the Ranger deal fell apart for the Islanders. And then the Philly thing, they were trying to clear cap space, which, you know, they seemed to do for 10 years. And they couldn't do it. So we were still in the mix. And I think, you know, Billy, I obviously wanted to play in Pittsburgh but he just wanted to, but that was one where it went away. And well, actually, that went away and came back right at the deadline. The other one was when I traded for Joe McGinley, Pittsburgh. You know, it was all over TSN that he was traded to the Bruins. And I called Jay Fischer, who was the GM in Calgary at the time, and said, "Hey, it's like at midnight." And they were playing a game at home, I remember. So I remember I texted him or called him and said, "Hey, congratulations on your deal. And I appreciate, you know, our conversations and, you know, good luck with it. Hopefully it works out." He goes, "Ray, we don't have a deal." I'm like, "What do you mean you don't have a deal? I'm watching on TSN. He's going to Boston." "Yeah, he hasn't waited to go to Boston." I'm like, "Are we still in it?" He goes, "Yeah." I'm like, "Oh, okay. What do you want?" So I think we did the deal in like 20 minutes. And I remember I texted my kids, I think, and, you know, once I knew the trade call is going to be completed like at 1 a.m. And my kids are like, I texted my kids, "Hey, we got Joe McGinley." And my kids are like, "Yeah, Dad, that's funny. He was going to Boston." I'm like, "Well, no, he didn't really go to Boston. How do you know?" I'm like, how do I know? I mean, come on. Oh, yeah. But my kids were a little skeptical. And that just came back. And one of the funny parts of that story, though, is that longtime defenseman Aaron Ward, who I don't know Aaron, I haven't met him, but I think he's the one that, you know, because he had the Boston connections, that broke the story, you know, again with Boston. And sure, he got a lot of crap for that, I guess. But I thought it was, I think it was July 1st when again was signed with the Bruins, and Aaron Ward, July 1st, after the signing comes out, he says about Jerome again, Aaron Ward tweets out, "Again, little Boston, told you." And,
a few months later.
Yeah. Anyway, it's great to see that, you know, Jerome, what a wonderful guy. Really, really enjoyed getting to know him and having him on his team. And but it was, you know, to see he's got two kids now and obviously two really good hockey players and actually a daughter playing as well. And so it's great to see. And yeah, but some of those deals you just never know. And when I think of some other ones, I'll tell you when I see you.
Leadership by example for Jerome McGinley. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And no ego whatsoever. And that's, you know, one of the things, too, is that I think that was 2013. We had a real good team in Pitt, and I think that's when we acquired McGinley, Brennan Morrow, and I think Jussi Jokinen, I think, at the deadline. And what I, you know, obviously McGinley and Brennan Morrow, both captains, Brennan in Dallas and Jerome in Calgary. But what you found out is that when they walked in that locker room, that was like Sid and Gino's team, right? So they deferred to them a lot. And, you know, it was unfortunate because, you know, it was 2013, I believe. And so it was a few years after the golden goal that Crosby scored against the U.S. in Vancouver in the 2010 Olympics, assisted by Aginla. But as Brian Burke will always say, went off of Curry's leg, the referee, and he's a Canadian. That's the way they won. So, but they only played one shift together. It was the first shift of the game after we traded for him. And it was an afternoon game against Buffalo, and the crowd is so pumped up. And first shift, and the first and only shift that Crosby and McGinley played together was they were buzzing in the offensive zone. Puck goes back to the point. Brooks Orpik takes a slap shot, hit Crosby right in the face, broke his jaw, and missed 20 game, whatever it was, and came back, I think, the second game of the playoffs or something like that. But that would have been great to see them play together. And you know, that would have been nice to do, but you know, having guys like that though, and you know, Hall of Fame person, Hall of Fame player, and you know, wish we could have won a cup with us. It would have been great.
I think, ironically enough, today is the anniversary of that golden goal game from the Olympics.
Oh, is it? Oh,
I
wow!
I think I just saw that on Twitter this morning.
Is that right?
Yeah, crazy that you'd bring that up.
Buyers
versus sellers, Ray. This mm-hmm. time of year, trade deadline approaching, Minnesota. You know, a team that's mm-hmm. on the cusp. How did you manage buying versus selling, where your team's at up until sometimes the last minute?
I think the standings obviously are telling you a lot. Certainly, you know, if the standings could tell the Philadelphia Flyers something, I have no idea. But if this was the year for the Flyers that, you know, part three or year four of their retool, whatever they call it, they might do something differently than, you know, but they have a, you know, they have a decision whether to, you know, to sell a bit at, because they have something, you know, longer term in mind, and versus, let's say, some other teams. So everybody's in a different situation. And when I was GM for Pittsburgh for 8 years, and, you know, we're buying every year. And I remember after 1 year of, you know, like, it'd be just what if we could sell 1 year, you know? and actually, Steve Eiserman in Tampa did that a couple times in Tampa Bay. And it wasn't just like this. They made the playoffs and went to, you know, And that was actually beneficial for them because they got some impact players because of that. But, but when I was in Jersey for 4.5 years, we bought 1 year, but sold three, and selling is not that good, trust me. But I think it's just in terms of where you are with your franchise and versus you're selling or not. And, but again, the timing to do it too is still always a conundrum. And I know one thing, we've got players on expiring contracts and you may trade them, may not. Like every time the guy gets hit or something like that, you're just, oh God, like, because, that could change things a lot. And, I remember when I traded Taylor Hall to Arizona, I think it was maybe in January. I don't think the deal would have been any, like, I didn't want it to, and he had some injuries during the course of the year. And, I kind of knew what I wanted and what teams were willing to give. And, once you knew you have that deal, and because you always, there's at risk, and if the deal's not there for you, then just wait. And you learn from GMs like that. I learned a lot actually when I was younger. GM and Pitt learned that from Jimmy Rutherford, and I thought he was bullshitting me. Like, think you know, I was trying to, I think I was trying to get Ray Whitney from him, and they were out of the playoffs. And he goes, "Well, here's what I want." It was one of our roster players, their first round pick. I'm like, "Jimmy, like, there's no way." And he goes, "Well, if you change your mind, let me know." So that's like 2 weeks for the deadline. So a week before I check in with him, same price. I'm like, I don't think so. So a couple of days before I check in with him, "Hey, any change on Whitney?" "No, he's still here." I'm like, "Yeah, I know that. Like, anything else?" "No, my price is my price." I'm like, "Okay, well, I can't do that, Jimmy." And so the next day, the deadline comes and goes, and it, let's say it's 3 o'clock Eastern time. It might have been like, I remember saying to our groups, I'm like, "Hey, where did Ray Whitney get traded to?" Because he had a no trade and all that stuff. And guys were like, "I haven't seen anything yet." So at like 4 o'clock, an hour after the deadline, trades are still kind of rolling in on whatever. And I'm like, "Oh, whatever." I picked up the phone and called Jim. I go, "Jimmy, did you trade Ray Whitney?" He goes, "No, I didn't." I'm like, "You didn't?" "No, I didn't get the deal I wanted." I'm like, "So you're serious?" He goes, "Absolutely." I'm like, "Wow." He said, I respect that. He said his price. He wasn't kidding. And you know what? I didn't get it. So I kept him. He's more value to me, even if not going to make the playoffs, and trade him somewhere that I get a, whatever. So those are the things you kind of pick up and learn, and you try to keep in mind and how people operate. And so that's kind of good, just the experience of that.
What was Bill Guerin like as a player?
He was a lot of things. I guess during, they just look at his career, and I knew him back when he was at Boston College and stuff like that, but I think he obviously, he was a very good player to begin with, but I think Billy is 6'2", 2 1/4 when he was playing, and he could skate and shoot, and he had a hell of a career for a reason. And two cups, and one at the beginning of his career with New Jersey as a young guy, an impact player on that team, and certainly with Pittsburgh at 38 years old. He reads people really well. And again, in terms of what we needed in Pittsburgh, him coming in and really, I think that trade deadline to bring in Billy Guerin and Chris Kunitz at the time, at the deadline in 09, were, obviously we're fortunate on both fronts that it worked, because you might, everything looks good, like, okay. But Billy's the only trade I did in my 13 years as a GM where my entire staff was no.
Wow.
And that's the only trade I ever did where I'm like, you know what, I'm doing it anyway. If I could do it, I'm doing it. And but that's sometimes those are the decisions you have to make. And because it wasn't, Billy wasn't playing that well with the Islanders, and he had kind of checked out, like, not checked out, but emotionally they were out of the playoffs. He's in the second year of a 2 year deal. And he's like, "What the heck?" And
Well, you
you
said
know, like,
they were sitting him out, right?
yeah, they were sitting him out. They obviously didn't want to get hurt or whatever,
Right.
prior to a trade. And Billy was like, they were up front with him, I think. And of course, and so in terms of that, but I think getting him, just, he just made other players better too. I mean, on top of being able to play on your first line, let's say, even at 38 years old, like, cripe, like, and scrumming for the net, him and Kunitz are right there. It was quite different ad than we had for our team a couple months earlier. And but they could play, they could skate, they were physical, and that's the way Billy played. And Billy played the game to win. And he had a big impact on people and players. And it was really, that deal, to see how it worked out for him, and how his family really enjoyed Pittsburgh, and that was really great to see. And but that's what he was, a player. And He's a people person anyway, and so I think, you know, for our group, especially we had younger players like, you know, Jordan Staal and Crosby and Malkin, they're all 23 and left. It was very good like that. Gary Roberts would have been the same way, coming in with that young group. And so I think, I remember, like, we put Gary Roberts in 08 when we traded from the deadline right next to Jordan Staal, and Jordan was 19, I think. And Jordan's trying to make small talk with Gary, and Gary's like 40, right? And Gary's and Jordan's just like, do you have kids? Like, you have a daughter. What's her name? Jordan? Oh, how old is she? Don't even ask. Sorry, Jordan. But anyway, but those, you know, those guys that come in, and you've seen it over the course of the years, obviously, and everybody has been in different sports, and that someone comes in and makes a difference. But you never know, especially the deadline. And, you know, you think it's going to be a good fit, but that's the thing. And, you know, there's no guarantee, that's for sure. But when it does work, it's pretty satisfying.
When did it become a possibility for Bill Guerin to get into a front office capacity? When did you first see that as an option for him? Did he come to you? Is it something you saw, you know, when he was a player, that management could be in his future?
I'm not sure I could say that, Joe. I think when Billy came to me, it was because of the advice I gave him after his second year with us, and he had scored 20 goals, and we went to game 7 of the second round and lost. And that was the hardest decision I ever made, is to make that call to him and say we were not going to resign him. And, you know, then we had talks after that. And he went to training camp with the Flyers and actually in a tryout. And then when that didn't work out, he's like, forget, you know. But I said, you know, the advice I'll give you, you have 4 kids, is take the year off and, you know, just spend time with your family and just see what your passion is. And sure enough, it might've been the following summer, or he just called me, and he was still living on an island, and the family actually wanted to move back to Pittsburgh. And he goes, Ray, I'm not asking for anything, but, you know, if you hear that we might move back, it's nothing more. But yeah, I'd love to be involved in anything. So, you know, kicked around with Tom Fitzgerald, who I'd hired a few years earlier as our, you know, director of player development. And so that's how we really started. Billy is almost job shadowing Fitzy and all that stuff, and especially his first year in that role. Then you can see, like, I think I was with Billy 2 years maybe then. But you can see how he grew. And then when Jimmy Rutherford came in, you know, my style is different than Jimmy. And I think that's good for people to, you know, work with different ideas and different backgrounds. And you see, you know, it's no different than you see Billy Guerin now, and you know, where his career has gone, and his confidence in things. And I think that's, you know, with anything, you get that with experience, and you get confidence in yourself. And, you know, and I think you see that within a John Hines. He sees the growth in a John Hines, and, you know, that's the thing. And, you know, people that get let go sometimes come back a lot better or more experienced or a different situation. It works out for them, not all the time, but, you know, I think that's a real good coach or a manager or a person like that. I think it's helpful. And, you know, you always give them that, you know, that look. And, but I think that confidence that Billy has now as an executive, and, you know, to see his appointment with USA Hockey, I think it's fantastic for him, his family, and certainly the Wild as well.
Tell me about David Poile and what allowed him to have such a long, successful career in the NHL.
Great communicator, really great communicator. You know, I was fortunate to work 8 years with him, and I think he just empowered people. And I think I took a lot from him. You know, he involved us with, you know, the coaches, the trainers, you know, Jack Dillo, the president, Craig Leopold, the owner, you know, and he would always, you know, be asking questions. And most of the time, David would probably know the answer, or, you know, he wanted opinions. He wanted those kind of conversations. And he'd always, you know, he'd get all excited. Hey, let's do this. And the first question always asked, why would they do that? Well, I don't know, but we should do it if we can. But why would they do that? Okay, you know, and again, instead of just reacting, okay, why would they do it? And again, David, he always wanted ideas, and there's no bad ideas, maybe a couple times, but I think, you know, he's so organized and detailed, and just a lot of people would grow underneath him in terms of the communication part, and he's a caring individual. And I think Nashville's the first team back in 98 to have her father's trip, and they've done a lot of great things. And, you know, to see that that, you know, Nashville become one of the prominent cities for the National Hockey League is fantastic and says a lot about, you know, obviously Craig Leopold back in the day that got the franchise there, and certainly David Poile is there from day one. And, you know, I think it was real satisfying to be able to bring back Barry Truss as the general manager and another wonderful person that, you know, they work well together. And I think that's what David's thing is, that he was, you know, just so detailed. And I think those were the things. And, but again, he empowered the people that worked for him. And, you know, the conversations, when you ask questions, I think you find a lot out. And, you know, again, whether it's a great conversation for him as the GM or not, it was always helpful for us, you know, because we're involved in the ideas. And, you know, I think that's how an organization grows and people grew. And that's how Nashville did it. It was fun.
What are the key ingredients to winning a Stanley Cup in today's NHL? And I phrase it that way because forever, you know, Patrick Waugh, Marty Brodeur, you had to have a number one goalie. That's kind of changing. The toughness factor, the speed, the youth factor in today's game has changed. What are the key ingredients today to winning a Stanley Cup, Ray?
A lot of those things. You need luck, obviously. You need health. It's a very, you know, you had four rounds, and you talk about, you know, going four rounds. And when I was in Pitt, we did it back to back, and it's a lot for the, you know, the players. And but you have to be lucky. And, you know, the team that raises the Stanley Cup, obviously we know there's only one of those, but every team that lifts the cup, they're going to say, but hey, we, that first round, we could have been out, or second round, we were so close to being out, or that maybe LA in 2012, they kind of went through a pretty good to the five, you know, but looking back, like when we won in 09, like we could have been out against Washington in the second round, we're down 2-0. We could have been down, we could have lost. I mean, it's just, I think in the semis, we might have swept Carolina 4-0, but we had to be lucky and good. And again, I think a lot of the goaltending is, as we know, is different now. And I think, you know, Vegas used 5, and they found a pretty good one at the end with Hill, obviously, and Hill. And, but I think, like with anything, it's the depth of your team. It is, you know, especially with overtime games, 5-on-5 overtimes, but the depth of your lineup is important. And that's not even including possible injuries during the course of a playoffs. And, but I think those are the things. And, you know, the depth of your team is important. And you see those teams like that. And again, timely scoring. And when Boston won in 2011, I mean, I think their power play was 15 out of 16 in the playoffs. And but their PK was number one. And no one, I don't think any goalie had a run like Tim Thomas did in that 11 playoffs. Like his save percentage, like, you know what, 94.5 or something like that. And it was crazy. But, you know, so you get away with missing on the power play, but with that kind of goaltending. And, you know, they obviously had a deep team, and but again, they could have been out. They were down 2-0 to Vancouver, and but they turned it around and they won. And they could have been out 2 rounds earlier in overtime in Game 7 against, I think, Tampa, in Game 7 against Montreal, and they won. Well, won in overtime at least. So it's hard. And if there anybody's betting on the playoffs in hockey, good luck. Like, it's a difficult one.
Your father Fred coached the Flyers to their only 2 Stanley Cups. Having grown up in Philadelphia, my dad was a fan of the Broad Street Bullies. So I have to ask you, obviously, about Fred. What kind of person was he? You know, I watched some of the podcasts you did previously where they talked a lot about your dad's personality, his style, his sort of his charisma. Mm-hmm. How would you sum up Fred?
Well, the daddy was wonderful. And, you know, I have a brother, and he never pushed either of us to sports, and it was always like school or law school or baseball, or, you know, if you're going to do something. And but he supported whatever he did, like my mom. And as the coach, you know, I hear this from all his ex-players, whether it's in the NHL or minors, that, you know, he was a player's coach. And I think, you know, I think he impacted people, and which is awesome. And but he was, you know, he had a quirky personality. And you know, but I think, yeah, you know, he was, you know, inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame, I think, in 2013, I believe. Which was awesome. And because the coaches from the builder category had not been included in a long time. And after my father was inducted, it was shortly after, like, I think Ken Hitchcock and some other coaches, was great to see. And that was nice. But I think it had an impact on the game. And I hear that a lot from his ex-players. And My dad passed away when he was 65. It would be great if he lived longer. I mean, I would be asking him all these questions that I should have probably asked him. And but back in the day, but anytime I wanted to go to the rink when I was a kid, you know, it was a long ride because back then, you know, everybody smoked. So to go from our house in Cherry Hill down to the Spectrum in Philly, it was probably 25 minutes, and that was about three or four lucky strikes. And you know, I was oblivious. You know, wonder I am what I am now. Like, that's secondhand smoke for sure, but I pay the price to go to the rink and go skating.
What were the Broad Street Bullies like to watch as a kid?
They were awesome. Like, honestly, I was my dad was there 7 years. So I was, I think, 9 to 16 years old, and so I remember almost everything. And I would be in a lock, and the players were just great. Like, I would, you know, I would steal Rick McLeish's sticks all the time because, you know, I loved his curve or whatever. The trainers, the players were great to be around. I was just a kid, and but you know, the players, the trainers, it was just a fun environment, and certainly, you know, growing up around that, and you know. It was fun, but at the same time, I remember my dad's first year was 1971-72, the Flyers. In his first year, they missed the playoffs, last game of the season. They had to get 1 point. Back then, they had ties. They were in Buffalo, and never forget, I was 9 years old, and they lost with 4 seconds left, 3-2. And like, I was crying, and my mom's coffee went up. This, like, she was like, "What the heck?" And but I'm in fourth grade. I'm in Philly, and walking to school. I'm so dejected. Talk about emotions. I'm in fourth grade. And but I get to the school, the schoolyard, kids are playing, you know, outside. And next thing I know, I go, "Hey, Shiro, your old man and Favell blew it." Doug Favell was the goalie. And I'm like, "Oh, fourth grade, what a tough crowd this is." And other than that, luckily it got better after that. But still, that whole team, those two teams, and the incredible attachment to that city, the fans to them, and vice versa. So Ed Snyder was an incredible owner and a caring owner, and did a lot for the families and did a lot for the players. And you know, it was a great era to grow up around, and I'm really proud of it. And but it was hard though when I was GM for the Penguins for 8 years, having to play the Flyers all the time. So that was tough. But you know, that was my team, Pittsburgh, at the time, so we wanted to beat them too. So but it was a great time to grow up around them.
The iconic quote, "Win now and we'll walk together forever," that your father uttered to the team as they're taking the ice trying to win the Stanley Cup. I'm assuming that was the first year. Maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, but is there a better quote? I mean, I love it. "Win now and we'll walk together forever." Just an amazing line.
It's he wrote on the chalkboard and before game six, the afternoon game against Boston, which the Flyers ended up winning 1-0. And that was, you know, "Win today, walk together forever." And that has been used so many times since then. Wish he would have trademarked it. And it was so funny. I think when Baltimore won the Super Bowl a few years ago, it was John Harbaugh was the coach, right? And I remember reading Sports Illustrated, and he told the Baltimore Ravens before the Super Bowl, "Win today, we will walk together forever." And I'm like, okay. And then I'm reading and he's like, "You know, Fred Shero, who coached the Philadelphia Flyers, won two Stanley Cups, but he wrote this in the book." Like, God, someone actually said my dad's like, that's good. Remember that. But it's a wonderful quote. It's been used a lot. But it really is. It's, you know, it's very applicable to that 74-75 team, or, you know, 73-74, and those back-to-back cups there. And they have, I mean, the entire city there. And, you know, it might be a little different now, like in pro sports in particular, where there's so much free agency, and, you know, you're not like it was back then. There, you know, you basically teams own players' rights in perpetuity, so people aren't going anywhere. And you did walk together, and but now with free agency. But still, when you win with that group, and especially when you know, you see your name in the Stanley Cup with that group of players and trainers and, you know, coaches you've gone through things with, and it's really worth it. And but again, that says win today, walk together forever. And yeah, I remember that. That's for sure.
All right, Ray, I'm going to let you go on this. I do
Yeah.
something at the end of an interview called Quick Hits. It's going to be five
Okay.
things, and I want the first thing that comes to mind.
Got it.
All right. Describe Sidney Crosby.
Intense.
Describe Marc-Andre Fleury.
Intense, funny, competitor.
Give me an example, if you can, of a scout who fought so hard for a player that you had to acquire him.
Back in, there's a few for sure, but when I was just in GM in Ottawa, I think it was 1994 draft, and we're in the sixth round. We had two sixth round picks, and John Ferguson Sr. was all over Randy Sexton on this player all year, and it was from Sweden. And anyway, it turned out fought, and finally Randy just said, we're taking the next pick. And I don't think we did. And we waited four more picks to take with our second sixth round pick. It was Danny Alfredson.
Wow.
And yeah. And so, you know, that obviously turned out well for the Senators, and Alfie's back to the organization on the bench, which was awesome. And, you know, the same thing, I think, in the 93 draft, the Pavel Dimitra in the ninth round. We had Pavel Dimitra. I was the Quebec draft. We had Pavel Dimitra rated 24th overall. And that was before computers. And without, I'm telling you, it was my first ever draft. I've been on the job for like 2 weeks. I didn't know many of the players, whatever. That wasn't my job at the time. And finally, it might have been in the eighth round, maybe, because I think there was like 11 rounds or something. And someone came to John Ferguson Sr. and said, you know, back then you just cross guys out with your yellow highlighter. And someone said at the table, hey, who took Pavel Dimitra? I missed him. Someone else looked, I don't have, like, who took him? All of a sudden realized, what do you mean no one took him? So if someone goes to, maybe I went up to central registry at the, you know, front of the draft there and confirmed that no one took him. Well, yeah, well, the ninth round comes around, we take Pavel Dimitra, which is awesome, except that we had him in the first round, but it ended up being a great story. Pavel obviously became an incredible player and a wonderful, wonderful person to get to know. And but those things happen a lot, and everybody's got stories like that. And, you know, and so those are the fun stories. And, you know, there's the other ones where they don't work out so well.
2009, Game 7, Joe Louis Arena. You're trying to win the Stanley Cup. Penguins, Red Wings. You just lost them the year prior. Before Game 7, were you nervous?
Yeah, for sure. Again, we were down 2-0, like the loss of the first 2 games in Detroit. But we felt we played really well. Same as earlier, the year before, we lost the first 2 games. But, you know, looking back, those Detroit teams were so good. Like, oh, my God, they were good. But we came back home, and we talk about resiliency. We won 2 and tied it up. And then we go back to Game 5 in Detroit. I'm like, okay, we got shelled, like 5-1. And I think Marc-Andre Fleury got pulled out in the second period. But we came back to Game 6 and won 2-1. And that goes like in Game 7, 1-2-1. And but that, even those last few games, like the guys that really, when you think of Crosby and Malkin, all those guys, but it was really, and they were fantastic, but the guys that were the, you know, the Matt Cook, Jordan Staal, Tyler Kennedy, Max Talbot, those are the guys you talk about winning with in terms of that depth of your team. And some of those guys get shut down, the top guys, and we were fortunate with that. But yeah, I was real nervous in that one. And maybe I should have been more nervous, I don't know, but I mean, everybody watches that last save by Mark, the 2 saves by Marc-Andre, you know, off the faceoff. And the thing is that was like with 7 seconds left or something, right? Off the faceoff. But like 9 seconds earlier, or the 16 seconds left, the faceoff was outside our zone. How in the heck did it come down to that? And we talk about sometime in terms of what happens if they had tied it and you have to go back and regroup and come out for overtime. And if you lost that, I don't know. And that would be a tough one. And I don't like to think about that one.
Lastly, what'd you do with your day with the Stanley Cup?
We were down at Cape Cod, at the really good buddy's house of mine, and right on the Bass River. And we had an incredible day. And, you know, and I remember it was funny. The year before, I was down after we lost in the finals, and a bunch of us were on the dock in my buddy's boat or whatever. And someone asked me the question, my buddy said, hey, if you win the cup, we're going to do the cup. I'm like, I don't know. Never thought about it. Well, if you win next year, what are you going to do? And I'm like, oh, well, free to hear. Well, how the heck do you know that, right? So sure enough, when we won, my buddy's like, hey, you said it, bring it down here. I'm like, okay. We had a great time, but everybody's got their stories of what they did with the cup during their day. And it's a great thing and wonderful for the families. And you always give back to the communities as well. And it was really great. And that was it.
Ray, thanks so much for joining me. It's been really nice getting to know you over the last couple of years. We don't cross paths that often, but when I do get to see you, it's always a pleasure. You got such a great personality, such a wealth of knowledge. Thanks for your time. Keep up the great work with the Wild, and it's obviously been one heck of a career to this point. So very proud to have gotten to know you, and again, thanks for doing this.
Well, I appreciate it, Joe. I can say the same thing, and it's wonderful to get to know you as well, and I look forward to seeing you next week. And thanks again for the time. That was fun.
That's Ray Shiro, senior advisor to Wild GM Bill Guerin. We talked about all his accolades before he jumped on with me. What a great career he has had. Hope you enjoyed this episode of One-on-One with Joe O'Donnell, presented by SodaStick. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.